Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey everyone, David Kern here. Welcome to Close Reads. Before we get into the show today with our special guests, Karen Swallow Pryor and Joshua Gibbs, who are joining Heidi White and I for our discussion of Frankenstein, I wanted to remind you about how you can join the conversation. Head over to Facebook, search for Close Reads in that search bar, and you can join the conversation over on the Close Reads Podcast discussion group. And over on Instagram, you can follow us at Close Reads Podcasts. We also have our newsletter, which is closereads.substack.com. And we have bonus episodes and some sweet show swag over at patreon.com/closereads, where we are currently discussing Crime and Punishment a little bit at a time. The Close Reads audience is the greatest audience in the podcast world, and we're thankful that you've taken the time to be a part of it. So thanks for that. Thanks for listening. And with that, here is today's episode. Hello and welcome back to Close Reads here on the Close Reads Podcast Network. I am David Kern and I am joined by our regular contributor, Heidi White, and our good friends, Karen Swallow Pryor and Joshua Gibbs. Welcome back to the show, everyone.
Hello. Hi. Thanks, David.
So we are here to discuss Frankenstein, as has been the case the last several weeks. We're here to discuss Volume 2, Chapters 6 through 9 of Frankenstein. In just a second, I'm going to ask Josh to kind of give us the rundown of what happened during those chapters. Because what I was noticing is that a lot of people couldn't put this book down. And so they read the whole thing. It's not terribly long. So they read the whole thing prior to the first episode, or maybe sometime between the first and the second episode. So as is often the case with those of us who are on the show, sometimes we lose track of exactly which section we're talking about at any given time. So maybe a little summary can help with that. Before we do that, though, I want to ask Karen a question. Because, Karen, you're working on a annotated version of this book through B&H, as we've discussed. And I thought a lot about you during rereading this section, because there's this question of virtue that runs throughout this whole section. And in On Reading Well, the concept of virtue is something that is front and center on the role that reading can play in helping us live virtuous lives, and on the theme of virtue in literature. Is that why you chose this book to be one of the first, well, the first four that you decided to annotate? Now, I don't know how many, you could probably do these annotated versions for the rest of your life, but you did choose, you prioritized Frankenstein over many other books. So I'm wondering if that is part of why you chose to prioritize this book.
That's actually a really good question. And the funny answer is no, because I actually, it's so funny because in our first chapter for today, chapter 6, I have the word virtue circled and a note to myself to do a word count when I get the electronic text, because yes, virtue, the word and the idea occur quite a bit in this work. So I actually wasn't, I haven't taught this novel for, I don't think I've taught this novel since On Reading Well has come out. Okay. And so rereading this for this program and for, as I'm working on my edition, virtue is just sticking out to me far more. But I will say that I was aware of that, and also a sort of counterintuitive fact about Shelley's mother, Mary Wollstonecraft, who wrote A Vindication of the Rights of Woman. I love teaching that work, especially in a Christian environment, a conservative Christian environment, because my students sort of assume when we open up the text, the central text of the woman called the mother of modern feminism, they're very surprised at what they see, because Wollstonecraft talks about nothing more than virtue. And of course, we know that Shelley, Mary Shelley's knowledge of her mother was only because her mother died shortly after her birth, that her knowledge was through her books primarily. And she read her mother's works a great deal. And so I see her mother's influence here in talking about virtue. And it's just something we don't normally associate with the Romantics. And so I have a note here to talk about that in my edition. So good eye.
Well, do you, before we dive deeper. I mean, you mentioned that it's not something that the Romantics were known for. And Heidi and Josh, you can jump in on this as well. Does that make her distinct among the Romantics, or does it kind of reveal ways that Shelley is sort of anti-romantic compared to, say, her husband and the people that they were, you know, hanging out with?
Yeah, I mean, I would say, and I would love to hear what Josh and Heidi have to say about this as well, but I would say, I mean, when we're looking at the Romantics and their sort of reaction against the neoclassicism that preceded them, it's really a matter of emphasis. So it's not as though, so when I teach, say, a British literature survey class, and we'll do things in chronological order, and we'll talk about how the neoclassical writers emphasized sort of the ethical aspect of the literature, and then the Romantics come in and focus on the aesthetic. But it's not either or. It is a matter of emphasis. And I do think, this has come up before with this novel, I do think that Mary Shelley is a romantic who is also interrogating romanticism. And so I think her emphasis on virtue is more her mother's influence and goes against, you know, the real lack of virtue among her husband and his peers. So, yeah.
Josh, do you think that, let me ask this, how much into the romantic writers are you personally?
How into them?
Yeah.
Like, are you really, really into them?
I like them, but I don't like them.
Yeah, but maybe can you unpack that a little?
Pull them on your leg. I enjoy romantic art a good bit. I think that romantic art was the first art I ever really appreciated for its own sake. Romantic writers, I have deep experience with a very few of them. So I don't have a broad knowledge. Mm-hmm. I've read a few.
Like the highlights?
Yeah, and I've read those many times. In my mind, because romanticism is so reactionary, it ends up unwittingly absorbing an awful lot about neoclassicism by accident, and often in sort of embarrassing ways that that the romantics might not have been able to identify. Neoclassicists and romantics seem a good bit like, you know, Tom and Jerry to me. They're at odds with one another, but they also desperately need one another as well. And so in a book like Frankenstein, I see a lot of analogs between Frankenstein and a book like Rousseau's Social Contract, wherein romantics and neoclassicists claim to disagree on an awful lot, but they're often two sides of the same coin. So it seems to me that almost any romantic, to be a romantic is to straddle romanticism and neoclassicism. I mean, for example, romantics and neoclassicists both like drugs. They just like very different kinds of drugs. The neoclassical drug is Ritalin, or something like that. Don't take that statement literally, but drugs that allow for greater control. Whereas the romantic drug is opium, a drug that allows for release. But they both have a kind of fixation. Their rival fixations are often manifested in the same way. They're both interested in the individual, albeit different sorts of expressions of the goodness of the individual. And so, you know, you see this in Rousseau's Social Contract as well. Rousseau's Social Contract is both taught as a neoclassical text or an enlightened text and a romantic text. It has both elements in it. So... But Karen was talking about how the book was an investigation of neoclassicism, which I think any investigation of neoclassicism from a romantic standpoint will end up borrowing an awful lot of neoclassicism just to conduct the investigation.
So when we say that it's an examination of neoclassicism or romanticism, to what extent do we think that she is... that it was an examination of those things sort of because of her osmosis of those worlds, or because she was actively, you know, trying to make a statement about it. You know, like how much of it was her exploring, you know, what was going on in her own head and her own experiences and with and experiencing life with people who were, you know, key figures of romanticism and having, you know, learned about neoclassicism, although maybe she didn't call it that. But, and then how much of it was, you know, she was writing a thesis about it.
I wouldn't say that she's writing a thesis on it, but she certainly has a kind of backroom view of both neoclassicism and romanticism. Given William Godwin's thoughts on political justice, she has a sort of backroom view of what it means to be neoclassical. She gets to see the kind of unsavory side of neoclassicism living with William Godwin, but she also gets to see the seedy underbelly of romanticism. I mean, she just has an insider's view on both of these things, having spent her life with William Godwin and Percy Shelley, who might be, you know, more fitting exemplars of either school of thought.
Mm. Okay, so let's take a step back here. I mean, and then we're going to take a step forward into the book. It strikes me that for some people, we may be talking about terms that are, you know, undefined, that we haven't necessarily defined them clearly. Heidi, you can jump in here if you want, or whoever wants to do this, but could we do a quick definition of each of these terms? We've talked about romanticism a lot. I think people will have a sense of that if they've been listening. What's the difference, the big differences between neoclassicism and romanticism? Karen, could you speak to that, like the big differences between those two schools?
Sure. So neoclassicism is considered really, at least in British literature, roughly the middle, early to middle 18th century. You could even say it goes as far back as, you know, just the Enlightenment, 1660. So, I mean, like the word suggests, it is a new sort of classical period, a return to ancient classicism. So in art and literature and thinking, the neoclassicists used as their model, ancient Greek thought. And so I guess in terms of the aesthetics of neoclassicism, this is some, you know, sort of some illustrations that I often draw upon is that, you know, if you think about architecture, the neoclassical, the exemplary building would be one that is symmetrical and has columns and is even and regular. And so you will see in much, not all, of course, the literature of the neoclassical age, a similar pattern. So we have an Alexander Pope heroic couplets that are very neat, even, and regular. Whereas in Romanticism, if we want to use an architectural kind of metaphor, it would be like a medieval cathedral, which is irregular and dark and mysterious and, has flying buttresses and gargoyles on the top. And so
spires.
So the literature will also, you know, emphasize the mysterious, the supernatural, the dark, the intuitive rather than the logical. So we can see, you know, so as we talked about earlier, one is kind of a reaction against the other, but it really is more a matter of emphasis. Everything doesn't fall neatly in those categories, but basically neoclassicism is sort of the child of the Enlightenment and the scientific age, and romanticism is kind of the rebellion against that. So I don't know if anyone wants to add anything else.
I do. I'm really interested in the question of virtue that David brought up, and also the other question that David brought up, two very good questions, which is, how much was Mary Shelley examining these things critically, and how much was she so immersed in them that they're just part of the furniture of her mind and she's just, you know, accepting them and putting them into her work? And I'm not sure about the second one. And I thought about that a lot as I was reading. But to go back to the question of virtue, it's long been understood in Western culture and in Western literature specifically that virtue is the golden mean, the mean between two extremes. And Karen, you talk about this a lot in On Reading Well, and it's brilliant. It's one of the best expositions of this in literature I've ever seen, but it's pervasive throughout literature. What is virtue? Virtue is the mean between two extremes. To be courageous is to not be rash, nor to be cowardly, but to be in the golden mean. And that comes from Aristotle. And what you were saying earlier made me think of this with neoclassicism and romanticism, which are both celebrations of extremes. And you have extreme rationalism, and then you have extreme emotion and sentiment and the internal world versus the external world, these things. And there's no middle ground between them. There's a distinction. We're reading something neoclassical, we're reading something romantic. You can recognize it right off the bat. And if you're looking for it, and if you have the language for it, even if you don't have the language for it, you're going to notice that they feel different and they're talking about different things. So we're not trying to use a lot of jargon. We just actually have a name for it, you know? But in this particular section, I kept thinking about basically what David was asking, is she doing this critically or not? Because the monster in many ways sounds so adolescent, right? I get one chance to be happy. And if not, I'm going to ruin the world. Like, and it's just so overwrought, which is people's main criticism with this book. And
Frankenstein, the monster should have read How to Be Unlucky.
Right? Yes. And on reading well, thank you. If you could just read Paradise Lost well. But there's just this celebration of extremism. And or is it a celebration or is it a critique? Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the interesting questions of this novel. Is she looking at it critically, or is she, who's only 20, actually believe the monster only has one chance and puts this in the book? And I think that's one of the interesting interpretive questions, and goes to whether or not you accept our narrator's voices at face value, or whether there's something a little deeper and more critical going on. Hmm.
Hey, Josh, when you were teaching all of this, you know, in light of what Heidi's saying there, when you're teaching this book and you've read it, what did you say, this is your 13th time, 14th time, something like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, somewhere 12, 13th. Yeah.
That's a lot of readings. How much do you find yourself thinking about questions like the one we're talking about now, about the degree to which it's, you know, a romantic book or a neoclassical book? And then how much do you feel like you need to actually, you know, talk about that with your students? So on the one hand, how much do you find yourself, yeah, you know, thinking about it at this point? And then on the other hand, how much do you feel like you need to actually talk about that? I guess what I'm asking is this conversation a waste of time?
No, it's not. It's not. I think there's so many important conversations to have in this book that question shouldn't dominate a reading of it. But I think everyone knows that. And the question of, you know, whether it's a critique or a celebration. I mean, if you've got 3 weeks to spend on the book, that's one good day of conversation, maybe two. I don't think that the whole book comes down to that. Over the years, my favorite introduction to the neoclassical versus romantic debate is a book I reference all the time, Solomon Among the Postmoderns by Peter Lighthart, which is one of the best modern history books I've ever read. And there's a lot in that book which carefully shows the rival promises made by neoclassicists and romanticists, and as well as a picture of how the last 200 years has been largely incapable of choosing a side in the debate. And rather, modern popular culture is just this endless oscillation between the two, with occasional unfortunate attempts to make an alloy of them. But popular culture just keeps coming back to the Apollonian of the neoclassical period and the Dionysian of the Romantics. And there are certainly a few points in the book that lend themselves to a conversation about that.
Hmm. I just want to make an observation about this question, David.
Yeah, please.
As we said earlier, I think understanding Mary Shelley's life and what she's trying to do in this book is probably more important in this novel than any other really that I can think of. But there's also something that we can learn about art and artists by thinking about this question, and that is that I think, ultimately, we never really know I mean, unless the person sits down and tells us that because they're still alive or whatever, and we can believe them. But we don't usually know what an artist's intention is. But I think, you know, this is why artists are like prophets, because they see and receive a message about the times. And they may not understand it or translate it or know what to think about it, but they see it and they communicate it. So they're paying attention to things that other people are not paying attention to, and they're sharing what they see. And that's the most significant thing they do, whether or not they, or how much they sort of understand or translate what it is that they're seeing. Does that make sense?
I completely agree with that. And I do have kind of a nerdy geek out pleasure in trying to categorize books within their historical context. And is this whatever, can I put a piece of jargon on it? I like that stuff, but I'm way more interested in that on the human level and on the level of how does that then, how should we then live, right? And so whether or not it's romantic, neoclassic, whether or not she's critiquing or accepting, that stuff is interesting insofar as it addresses those questions that are profoundly human and relevant for our own times as readers in our own cultural moment, readers in this generation. They're trying to figure out what to do with the monster, which is real.
And I think I would, you know, I guess I we could just say that no work of art or literature is good if it completely accepts or completely rejects the time in which it is in, right? Because
that's good.
There's no critical distance there. So,
Well, let's segue into the section then. So again, volume 2. Volume 2, chapters 6 through 9. And Josh, I told people at the top you'd give a little summary. So can you take it away and just kind of remind us what happened?
Sure. Chapter 6 is an account of the history of the De Lacy family and their relationship with a fellow known as the Turk and his daughter, Safi. We should probably wait until a little bit later in the conversation to go too much further into their story, because there's so much of significance in this chapter. Suffice to say that the saga of the De Lacy family and the Turk and Safi is sort of an idealized retelling of Mary's life with her father and with Percy. There are a number of interesting analogies between the De Lacy's life and the Godwin's life. We have a father who promises his daughter to a young man, betrays that promise, and so on and so forth. But that's chapter 6, and we learn of how Safi ultimately came to the cottage and why it is that this family, the De Lacy's, who used to be great, has fallen into a kind of bad reputation. Chapter 7 is the chapter where the monster first begins reading classic literature and discovering himself in the stories of Paradise Lost, Sorrows of Young Werther, and Plutarch's Lives. And in reading those books, he comes to understand not only what his duties might be, but what duties other people might have to him. And I think that this is what prompts him to seek out Victor. He realizes that Victor owes him something. And he realizes this in studying human history, human virtue, the mythology of human creation, and so forth. Chapter 7 concludes with the monster trying to present himself to the De Lacy family in a way that he thinks will be favorable to his intention, which is to ingratiate himself into the family and become a kind of surrogate son. This fails. He has to quit the cottage. He burns the cottage to the ground after the De Lacy family in terror moves off. The monster has a series of interactions with people in his perambulations after departing the cottage, none of which end well. Finally, he discovers something in the pocket of a coat that he stole from Victor on his way out of Victor's apartment that gives the address or gives reference to who Victor is. And so he goes and seeks him. After finding Victor's family near Geneva, he kills William in the story that we encountered earlier in the book. And then having finished his story, he makes his request one more time, or he makes his request formal. I need a wife. Victor debates the matter for a moment. The monster offers all sorts of promises and securities that he'll leave Victor alone if he just gives him what he wants. And Victor begrudgingly agrees in the end.
Okay, so this section obviously raises the question of whether or not Frankenstein should go ahead and fulfill the request of the monster. Should he make the make Frankenstein's bride? And I want to talk about that in a minute, but I want to ask you guys a question first, because what we've gotten here over these last several chapters is the monster's account of his adventures. And one of the things that we talked about quite a bit over the first few episodes was the question of characters being trustworthy in all these stories that are layered upon one another like an onion. Josh, you've talked about whether Victor Frankenstein is trustworthy, and you pointed out places where he seems to be contradicting himself. What do we think then of the trustworthiness of the monster himself in this retelling? Does he seem to be, do you think that he is perhaps the one character in the story who is trustworthy? And if so, why might that be? Or do we think that he is just another in a long line of characters who we have to take what they're saying with a grain of salt? Any of you can jump in here. Josh, you can maybe, if you want to jump in first, you can. I know you've got strong opinions on trustworthiness of characters in this book.
Well, it's one thing to question what the monster says about his past, but the end of his speech contains a lot of promises about what the future will hold. And so I'm less inclined to doubt the monster's account of what has happened, although I am suspicious that all the monster's promises to give Victor what he wants, leave him alone, be good, go off to some, you know, far-flung country and never talk with anybody again. I don't have a reason to believe that it would all pan out that way just because the monster says so. And part of the reason for that is, every time a person declares some object or other person to be not only the source of their happiness, but to be the source of their goodness, every time one person transforms another human being into a sacrament of righteousness, you have an idolatry that is doomed to fail. So when the monster claims, give me what I want and I'll be happy and I'll be good and everything will be great for the rest of time, that seems like Heidi mentioned earlier, that seems like the naivete of youth speaking. I mean, I could remember in my, you know, sullen teenage days thinking that if I just had a girlfriend, everything would be perfect, which is daft. That's stupid. Some things would be better and then some things would be far more difficult. So I guess my short answer is I don't have much of a reason to doubt that the monster has done what he has said he's done, but I'm not sure that he will do all that he says he will do.
Heidi, are you going to add to that?
Yeah, I think that Josh is right on the connection between virtue and happiness is a very big question in literature and in the human soul and in societies. On every level of human existence, we're asking the question, how do good and happy fit together? And to go back to Aristotle, his claim and the ancients' claim, the classical claim, is that happiness is a result of virtue, not that virtue is a result of happiness. And so that's long accepted, at least within Western culture, and I think within the Christian ethic. And that's reversed here. And this is a book of reversals. This is a book of it is not that the creator loves the creation and pursues relationship, but that the creator rejects the creation and pushes away relationship. This is a book of profound reversals throughout the entire thing. And this is one of the reversals. And so the question of, if you make me happy, then I will be good, that's a core belief of the monster. And we are right to question that.
Does the reversal that you're talking about, though, give more credence to his claim?
I think that that's one of the explorations of the second part of the novel, because that's the should question that you were talking about. Should Victor Frankenstein make another monster? Is he just doubling the evil, or is he mitigating the evil? Is he resolving it? And the monster's claim over and over again, which I think is extremely adolescent. To your point, Josh, I made this same exact claim because I am prone to all of the pitfalls and failings of the romantics. So Karen, you talked about how you're anti-romantic in every way. Like, left to myself, I would become the monster. So this is like the reversal in my own heart of maybe virtue leads to happiness, not happiness leads to virtue. That's like a very profound change for me in my personal journey. So I recognize it in the monster, right? I'm sensitive to it. My radar is up when I see it. And this goes to, you know, you bring yourself to your interpretation of a novel and learn from that, hopefully. So I think that your question, David, is does it give credence to his claim? I think is a big, the rest of the novel does not bear out that to answer it one way or the other. I think it's, we can either cast judgment or feel like pity for the monster based on what happens next. And so I do think that this kind of goes back to the question, is she critiquing or is she accepting? I can't always tell, honestly. I really can't.
Karen, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, okay, yeah, no, I have lots of thoughts here. Okay, so I want to nuance this point about the narrator and maybe use a different term. I think we talked a couple of episodes ago about... I could be wrong, but my contention is that, you know, the unreliable narrator is kind of something that happens later in literature, and we're kind of retrofitting that here. What made this novel so shocking to contemporary readers and critics was that there was not the unreliability of the narrator or narrators, since we have several narrators, but the morality of the narrators and the lack of a normative narrative voice. So in other words, we have, you know, we have Walton's story, we have Frankenstein's story, we have the monster's story, but we don't have an overarching narrative voice who's telling us how to interpret the morality and the stories of these narrators. The monster just gives his story and we critique it, as we just have. We say, wait, there's something really wrong with this. But we have to do that because there is no narrator outside, whether first person or third person, because both certainly had a long history, even by this time. There's no normative narrative voice cueing us in about how to interpret each of these narrators. That's what was so shocking to contemporary readers, what was so different. I think we can rely on each of these narrators expressing what they think and believe, and that they're telling the stories as they see them. But we're still left with the problem, what do we think about those stories? Because we don't have some, you know, great capital A author or capital N narrator out there telling us how to interpret them.
And this was the first time that was done, or is just a first time it was done?
I don't know if it was the first time, but it was the first time it was such like a shocking subject.
Oh, fair. Yeah, I see what you're saying.
You know, that, you know, obviously there's so many huge moral questions here. Yeah. And no one is telling, no narrator is telling us what to think about those questions.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. There's no sage guide to help you perspective on it.
Yeah. I mean, and maybe it is really, I mean, we've talked about the frame narrative and the reliance that Shelley has on, say, Coleridge's Rime of the Ancient Mariner. But even as, you know, the Rime of the Ancient Mariner is very straightforward in its morality. You know, so maybe this is one of the first works that really leaves this. We don't have the mariner telling us the moral at the end.
So at the end of this chapter 9, then, Frankenstein has made his decision. He says, I concluded, after a long pause of reflection, I concluded that the justice due both to him and my fellow creatures demanded of me that I should comply with his request. Turning to him, therefore, I said, I consent to your demand on your solemn oath to quit Europe forever and every other place in the neighborhood of man as soon as I shall deliver into your hands a female who will accompany you in your exile. So by the end of this section, he has made his decision. And do you think that, Karen, I'll ask you this first. Do you think that the book thinks he made the right decision? I mean, or you can answer if you think he made the right decision, but I...
You mean at this point in the story?
Yeah, like does the books, what does the book want him to seem to want him to choose, if that makes sense? I mean, or you can just say, what do you think was the right choice?
But again, at this point, right? I think in the world of the story at this point, it is the right choice because there's so much emphasis on friendship and love and the need for companionship. And I think that, you know, Frankenstein is feeling guilty for having made this creature and abandoned him and leaving him alone. He wants family. He wants friendship, Frankenstein himself. And so... I think at this point we are supposed to sympathize with the monster and with Frankenstein.
Josh, you unmuted yourself.
So let's do something a little difficult, maybe impossible for just a moment, and pretend that we don't know what's going to come after volume two.
Yeah.
Assuming we don't know what comes after, does Victor really have a choice in what he tells the monster at the end of his story? Within his own mind, what are the options here? Yes or no, and the monster follows him back to Geneva and begins systematically killing the rest of his family. I think within Victor's mind, that might actually be what the options are. And so this justification of, well, it was an interesting point, blah, blah, blah. I mean, this is just putting a kind of rational spin on irrational fear that's led him to make not really a free choice. I mean, let's go ahead and admit, Victor doesn't make this decision freely.
Yeah.
There's a threat. I mean, he makes the decision. He's responsible for it. If the will won't will, nothing can force it, as Beatrice says. But it's not exactly a free choice. There's a threat for saying no.
Yeah.
And I think we might ask whether Victor consents to the request, not for any of the reasons that he states, but just because he's been threatened and he's fearful of what will happen.
He's back to New Orleans.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I was thinking about how if you read it from that perspective, some of the things that he says, reflecting on his own thought process, are pretty funny. Like the degree to which he pretends that he's this great philosopher and has these great deep reasons. If you think about it from the perspective that he doesn't have a choice, it makes him seem, you know, like he thinks he's a lot smarter than he is. It makes him seem like a teenager, kind of.
Right.
Like, I paused to reflect some time on all that he had related and the various arguments which he had employed. I thought of the promises of virtues which he had displayed on the opening of his existence and the subsequent blight of all kindly feeling by the loathing and scorn which his protectors had manifested towards him. You know, like all these, you know, he gets to use a phrase you might hear around here in the barbershop. He gets a little highfalutin. And I actually have heard that phrase in a barbershop. It was a great day, one of the great days of my life. Heard it out in the wild. But there is a sense in which he seems to be trying, is he trying to make himself look better to his reader because of what happens later and what's happened so far? Like, is he trying to find ways to insert his own to show in some way or that he is virtuous despite everything that's happened?
Yes, he is. And everybody does that.
As someone who's done that many times myself.
Yeah. There's no way to not do that. When you do something morally ambiguous that has consequences to it, you go back and retell the story in your head and justify it to others. That's what you do. That's the human response. And that's what he does here. And there's... this is what I think classical thinking completely misses that the Christian ethic fills in. And that is that can anybody be happy or good or both without love ever, without being profoundly loved and loving in return? And that's the mitigation of the gap between happiness and goodness is love. And in that sense, if the question is, should Victor make a companion for the monster? I mean, there's all kinds of pragmatic concerns with that, right? There's all kinds of, would they just be, again, doubling the evil, or would it be, you know, you can look at it from all kinds of philosophical perspectives. But when it comes down to it, I think he should, because at this point in the novel, he should, because there's no other way for the monster to ever have to love or be beloved. And that is the cornerstone of human existence. There is no hope without that ever. And so you take the risk. So that's my, that's what I think at this point, how you answer that should question is what happens then if the monster is always profoundly alone? That's a cruel torment to any creature, and wrong not to attempt to mitigate that and resolve that. And so I do think that that's the only answer to the question, but it's such an enormous risk. And that goes again to the extremes that we're talking about within the romantic kind of sensibilities.
Mm-hmm. And let's not forget that Frankenstein is a retelling of the creation story that is retold in Paradise Lost of the creation story in Genesis, right? So we have the true creation, the true and good creation story in Genesis. And then we have Milton's wonderful, but somewhat, you know, problematic and agenda laden retelling of the Genesis account in Paradise Lost. And then we have this account, and this account really is wrestling with, you know, does a good God make fallen creatures or creatures able to fall? And the answer in this story is not a very good one, but this is a question that the novel is asking, is what kind of God makes creatures able to fall? And what does he do when he's done that?
I completely agree. And it conflates, in many ways, this story conflates the Prometheus account with the Christian story. Mm-hmm. And that the idea of forbidden knowledge within the Prometheus myth, that fire is a good thing that's being withheld from the creatures by the creator. It conflates that with the creation story in Genesis saying that the knowledge really... At heart, although it's not explicitly stated, it is implicitly within the threads of this novel that God, the Christian God, the creator, is withholding something good from the creation. And that's assumed within this novel, that the withholding of that knowledge is an act of cruelty by the creator toward the creation.
It's interesting then that here he has to beg for the companion, and of course in Genesis that's Adam doesn't really have to, you know, repeatedly beg and plead for.
But he does
in
Paradise Lost, and that's the account that he has. Adam goes to God and asks for a companion, and God answers and gives him the request. So there's all kinds of religious implications and assumptions within this, which is typical for the Romantics, that there's mm-hmm. this mm-hmm. questioning, this subversive nature towards institutionalized religion, which we all know what that's like in a society. So she is asking the question, and in many ways, not even asking the question, making the statement. It's an assumed posture in the novel that the creator is withholding good from the creation.
Speaking of religious implications, Josh, it felt like you were about to confess something, and I would hate to lose a chance to confess something.
I don't know if it was a confession. I'm intrigued by the monster's requests as parallel to Adam's requests, and so while I think it's often the case that in the beginning of things and at the end of things, the rules are slightly different. Whereas in the middle of things, there's a kind of continuation and normalcy and standard that has to be recognized. I have two observations about the creation of the second monster. The first of which is, if the creation of the first monster involved impiety, then does the creation of a second monster not also involve impiety?
Great point.
And if the creation of a second monster involves impiety, how can it be justified?
And if it doesn't involve it, how can it be a true companion to the first monster?
Right. I think that that's true. So I ask that not as a rhetorical question. That's a fair question that I'm intrigued by potential answers to. The other observation maybe is that while the rules are different in the beginning and while the rules are different in the end, what we have being set up here is an uncomfortable sexual relationship that mirrors Victor's relationship with Elizabeth. Because what the monster has asked for is a sister, basically, to marry. There's no way of viewing a second monster as anything other than a sister. Both monsters would share the same progenitor. At least with Adam and Eve, that's not exactly what's on the line. Although, again, we've all wondered about, I don't know, who Cain married, and must it have been his sister, and was there a choice? So I get it. In the beginning, the rules are different. But is what the monster is asking for, does what the monster wants, essentially boil down to a parallel relationship between Victor's unhealthy relationship with Elizabeth? Or do we have to view this as being potentially different?
That's a great point. A great point. And my earlier point of, yes, he should make the companion, was based on the assumption that nobody else would love the monster, and perhaps that's flawed. And maybe that's what it comes down to, is Victor should parent his monster, should love him and make room for him instead of rejecting him.
Yeah, I was struck by the fact that, you know, he goes to the old man, the blind man, and to DeLacy, and because he realizes the man can't see him, and so if he can just talk to him and get him to defend him and say, you know, this is a nice guy, then the people won't take him, you know, judge him just based on the way he looks. And it's, you know, that instinct does not also, he doesn't think, if I go to the one who created me, he will teach me and he will help other people understand that I'm not what I look like. That never even occurs to him to go to Frankenstein and say, the only thing he does is say, you hate me, so I'm going to, if you don't do what I ask and make me a companion, I'm going to kill you and everyone you love. That's the only instinct he has, because he seems to understand the terms. Maybe it's that when he was standing at the foot of the bed and Frankenstein freaked out, that set the terms of the war. And Frankenstein both Frankenstein and the monster seem to have accepted them in that moment. There was never any, you know, there was never any discussion that the terms could be different, or there was a different way forward or different possibilities for them to even have a relationship. Maybe that's the thing that is kind of the most heartbreaking in a way, is that that's never even a discussion that happens. There's no instinct in either of them to have a relationship between creator and creation. It's not even up for discussion. Unless I miss something.
There's so much othering that goes on in this novel. I mean, that's a whole other field of inquiry is just what the novel suggests about the other, capital O, about races. And we have different races in the story itself. Mm-hmm. But then if we think of the monster in terms of racial discussions and who is fit and proper for companionship, friendship, marriage, and the kinds of questions that we've asked and the kinds of ways we've approached that in our culture, which, with very different eyes look very similar to what's happening in this novel. I mean, we just recently celebrated in Virginia Loving Day, the day in which Virginia was required by law to allow people of two different races to marry, and we're probably not quite there, but we're almost in a place where we can look at that past as being as bizarre as the one here, where it was just assumed that this creature could not be a fit companion for any, whether spouse or friend to anyone else, and that's one of the things that's one of the fascinations of this novel. I'm sure Shelley wasn't necessarily trying to do that, but she was so tapped into the questions of her time that are still questions for our time that it continues to illuminate things like this.
How does the Paradise Lostness of it all fit into this theme? You have, he seems to see the monster that is, seems to see in himself, or compare himself to Satan in Paradise Lost. He seems to, I mean, there's obvious reasons why Shelley chooses to use that book, as for what you guys were just touching on. But why does he, is it because he is one of those people that sees the devil as the protagonist of Paradise Lost, or is it the devil's rejection? Is it that he reads the devil as this ugly brute creature that and he identifies with him? Why do you think he sees himself in that character in Paradise Lost?
Among other things, and I want to hear everybody's other things, it's because he has hell within him. And that's the definition of Satan within Paradise Lost. Everywhere I go is hell. I myself am hell. He encounters hell everywhere. He creates hell everywhere because he himself is hell. But he was created glorious. And I think that there's something like so profound in that. And by far, Satan, he is the best character in Paradise Lost.
Whether or not in terms of his complexity?
Yes, he's a great character. And it just, in literary history, Milton Satan is on in the top list. And because of that, like, there's just this.
Should we have an argument about that?
Maybe so. Sure. I made a definitive statement. I didn't know there was another point of view on that. I'm happy to hear it. But that's what the monster is wrestling with. And I think that this discussion of the books that he reads and then the finding out that he himself is his own hell that's just very profound reflections there. He reads these books, his soul is elevated. He thinks he loves virtue, but at the first sign of adversity, he creates destruction. And that you can't love virtue and then not apply it when it's hard. Like, he doesn't love virtue. He thinks he does because his soul is elevated by these words and inspired by them. But the whole point of virtue, is that you maintain it when it is challenged, or else you don't have it and you didn't love it. And but that's what he's saying is I am hell.
That goes back to the, go ahead.
The thing that's missing in the monster, though, is, and the thing that's profoundly absent in Milton's Satan, even though he knows that he is hell, is there's no repentance. Never. Like, never does the monster sorrow or grieve or repent, and neither does Milton's Satan. And in that, they're like twinsies.
But on the other hand, how would he know how to? I mean, people aren't necessarily, you know, anybody who has little kids knows that, you know, being virtuous when it's difficult does not always come easy. That's something, there is a, we talk about how we have to train people, right? In an overly simplistic way, we'll use that word train, but virtue is something that it takes, you never really master, you know, being virtuous, right, in difficult situations. And so he has no mentor. He has no one modeling what that looks like. He has no one showing him how to repent or, you know, modeling what repentance looks like. You know, there's no relationship there to reveal to him what that might look like, which I think I would argue is not true for Satan in Paradise Lost.
But he has Paradise Lost, right? So the monster has, he has the models. He picked a type to imitate. And that is, I think that somewhat goes to the weak point of an education that's based entirely on types, right? Which is what he had. He had types to observe. He had the family, the DeLaceys to observe, and he had the books. And he still failed the test when it came down to it because he had no humility. And to your point, does that have to be something that you find a type to imitate? I don't know. I think that's one of the questions of an education. And I think that it does delve into that.
It's never occurred to me that the virtue that the monster was lacking or that led to his problems was lack of humility. That was an interesting. When you said that was interesting. I've never thought about that before. I think maybe my instinct has always been that you make a good point about how he has Plutarch. You know, he has Plutarch's Lives and he has Paradise Lost. I think the choice of Plutarch's Lives in that way is really interesting because obviously for centuries those stories have been models for people. But is it that he has the wrong, or he lacks certain virtues like humility, or is it that he has incomplete visions of what virtues actually are? I mean, there's an immaturity to the way he would be able to understand and express them, right? Like just reading Plutarch's, sure, they're models, they're there, but it takes a lot of wisdom to take them out of the specific context and apply them to a different context than the one in you know, the life of Solon, for example. Josh, were you going to say something?
Yeah, I mean, I was going to agree with your point that while the monster's read Paradise Lost, it doesn't seem as though he's read it very closely. It seems maybe I could almost believe that he got bored around 9 books in and simply skipped the end of it.
Where's the battles?
Yeah. I mean, from the point that Michael begins lecturing Adam on the future history of the world, I mean, a lot of students zone out at that point. Maybe the monsters zoned out as well.
He skipped the wailing parts of Moby Dick, too.
Yeah, and it's interesting.
Who doesn't?
The monster... The monster reads Paradise Lost and seems to only trust the book up to about halfway through. And by that point, he's developed his impression of all of the characters that's incomplete. And these impressions are never challenged by the way that the book concludes. So it's interesting to me that he reads Paradise Lost and Satan is such a seductive figure that the fact Paradise Lost is a cautionary tale is lost on him. He simply absorbs the most arresting image that he finds. And he doesn't have a guide. There's no one to help the monster through the book. And I would say that for the average adolescent, Paradise Lost is not a book you should read on your own. Like, you should get someone to help you through it. And Frankenstein might be a great case for why people need guides through great literature, at least when they're young. You know, when you're old and you've allowed books like, you know, Paradise Lost and Plutarch's Lives to train you, then you can become the teacher and go off on your own. But the dangers of autodidacticism are on the line in the monster's story.
It might be worth looking at a couple of those passages closely where he is talking about reading, because I think what Josh has said is really insightful. So there's chapter seven, about, it's the second page or so into it when he's reading the Sallows of Werther. He says, as I read, however, I applied much personally to my own feelings and condition. I found myself similar, yet at the same time strangely unlike the beings concerning whom I read and to whose conversation I was a listener. I sympathized with and partly understood them, but I was unformed in mind. I was dependent on none and related to none. That seems like it was exactly what Josh was just talking about and the dangers of autodidacticism. And then, you know, he has sort of a similar reaction as he continues reading Plutarch's Lives and Paradise Lost. It came up last time too, but this is just a really key section on education and the potential of education, but also its shortcomings. I mean, it's not a magic bullet. You know, reading a book isn't a magic bullet. Even good books.
Right. Well, and I don't mean to keep harping on this, but I'm going to keep harping on it. He has nobody to love him. And that
you're the melody of this podcast.
I like that. I'll take it. But that's the thing that's missing. He has the types. Mm-hmm. And we do a lot, we talk a lot about types in education. He has them. Victor had them, right, in a lot of ways. And without divine and human love, they can fail because we all carry a hell within us that must be addressed and repented of. And that is the human journey towards salvation. And whether it's because there's nobody who taught him that, or if it's because that hell was stronger than the types, or a combination of both, that's one of the contemplations of this novel.
Can we just talk about the story of the De Lacys a little bit, both, you know, thematically and structurally?
I had a note right in front of me.
Since we're kind of in the middle of that now. Yeah.
So chapter six is where the primary gist of that story is delivered to us, right?
Yeah.
Josh, you summarized it a little bit. Was there something specific you want to touch on, Karen?
I mean, there's just so much. I guess I'll start with something I alluded to, you know, or an episode or so ago, just that this is the literal center of the story, you know, just structurally and thematically. We have a story within a story within a story. Well, the De Lacy story is the one that's in the middle. And so we need to think about that structurally. If readers out there are asking, what is this doing here? This isn't what in any of the film versions or whatever. Then I think that's something that we need to touch upon. What is this story doing here? We've already mentioned some of the things, but one main thing that it's doing is presenting kind of the idyllic romantic life, right? The family, this lovely family, who love one another, living in a cottage in the woods, happy, playing music. I mean, you can't get more romantic than this. And then the lover comes, estranged lover comes along, and then, you know, you can't even really get happier than that. Yet at the same time, there are all these sort of holes in the story. This questioning of this romantic, idyllic life. And so the monster's looking in, he's seeing this picture of a romantic life, wants to be part of it, thinks he can be part of it, but of course it falls short. I mean, he can't. He's gravely mistaken when he thinks that he will. So there are shortcomings to romanticism here. So I'll just stop there. There's just so much in this.
There's even the idea that the reason they're there is because they were participating in this in this cause that then caused them to be exiled. And that, there's a sort of, but wasn't Percy Shelley, didn't he, didn't die in Greece or something like that? Well, one of the romantic, was it Byron maybe who died?
Byron died
in Greece.
Byron,
fighting in...
Which of course hadn't happened yet, which is so interesting. Mm.
But it's like, and this is such a, even look at Wordsworth and Coleridge and all these guys who, Wordsworth and Coleridge were off at one point when they were young, and then they got this, sort of disenchanted with all these causes that they were involved in. But that, being involved in a cause that gets you exiled to the woods to have to live there is like the ultimate romantic.
Right.
The ultimate romantic, it's the ultimate romantic.
That's a great question.
What's the punishment? Like to get sent to the woods. Exactly, the reward. Yeah, is to get sent to the woods because you did something noble. I mean, how much better can it get than that? And then to have your lover join you there, it's the dream right there. What is it about their story that you think most is compelling to the monster? Because it seems to awaken in him a sort of personhood, his view on he begins to have a view of the world because he watches these people for a year. Not only does he learn stuff, like skills and how to read and write and things that are a little bit unbelievable, of course, but there's also his eyes are open to, he's sort of developing a world view, if you will. So what is it that he sees there that transforms him in that way and opens his eyes and is so compelling to him, do you think?
I mean, artistically, I just think this is the most brilliant part of the story because as you've already mentioned, plot-wise, this is how Shelley has him learn to read and learn English. I mean, it's really quite believable in a sense that this is how he learned. He learns to read and to study English, but he also learns about family and he learns about romantic love. Just by observing from the outside. There are just so many psychological, literary, sociological, philosophical truisms that truths that come out through this sort of drama within the larger drama. But I don't know. I want to hear what Josh and Heidi have to say.
Well, Josh, you had that squinty contemplative look that as if you were about to say something. So
no, I think Karen asked a great question. I forget if it was Karen or your name. What is it about the DeLacy family that awakens the monster to a desire for romance, for a desire for companionship? So, I mean, part of it's Paradise Lost, but Paradise Lost will only be an abstraction to the monster unless he sees that it's possible for such romance to play out in the material world.
Yeah.
Which is why a good education cannot be, sequestered off in the realm of abstraction. There's a lot of living that must be done that helps make sense of classic literature. There's a good bit in Paradise Lost that will not make sense to you until you've been betrayed by someone you love. And until you've experienced that, the book can't make sense of it for you. So one of the reasons why we need to go back to classic literature over the course of our lives is because we gain more and more experiences by which to understand classic literature. So, I mean, when you when you read Paradise Lost at the age of 16, you simply haven't done enough living to understand most of the book. You've done some living. You can understand some of the book. But when you come back to it, 21, 26, 31, you will have experienced, the death of a friend probably by the time you hit 31. You will have had your heart broken by then. You will perhaps have married and have a child and have all manner of fears that emerge for the safety of a child that you cannot absolutely guarantee. And Paradise Lost will make more and more sense the more and more you live. But the question of what exactly the monster sees in the De Lacy family that he wants is very interesting. How exactly the monster's life would have been changed if he had witnessed Felix and Agatha break up is another interesting sort of question. What if they weren't perfect romantic partners and they had a normal sort of relationship? What would the monster make of that? And also, it's interesting that having observed the De Lacy family and having read Paradise Lost, that the relationship that he wants is a romantic one, not a familial one. He doesn't want a relationship like De Lacy has with Felix. He doesn't want a relationship like God has with Adam. He wants a relationship like Adam has with Eve, which is intriguing.
Hmm. I've never thought about that before, that his next step is immediately the romantic connection. I think that that's a fascinating observation, Josh. Thank you for that. I'm going to think about that. I think the thing that he wants is love.
So is that the most intense form of love? And so that's the one that he most gravitates to?
Yeah. And I think that's why I'm so intrigued by Josh's question, because it seems it's a very compelling question, because I think when he sees the family, he's drawn to that domestic ideal, that core human unit, which is the family. And there's multiple connections in that household. There is a romantic one. There's the sibling one. There's father and daughter. There's father and son. There's a lot of connections, but the one that he takes away as a longing, as a desire that he has attached, if I were to have this, I would be happy and then it would be good, is the romantic one. And I think that is a worthwhile interpretive question. But I do think the thing he's drawn to is the idea of human connection. It's to love and be loved, and to see that these loved people are both happy and good is compelling to him, and awakens in him longings that go beyond the books. And I think that that's an interesting, because he sees that first and then he finds the books, which in some ways is entirely pragmatic, because he has to observe them in order to learn how to speak and how to read in order to get to the books. But it is that he says that he longs for that, and for virtue and for happiness and for love, even before he gets to the books.
Yeah, it is only after the monster tries to incorporate himself in the De Lacy family and fails that he decides to seek out romantic love.
Right.
And it's a little interesting that having failed to incorporate himself into the De Lacy family, he's absolutely confident that a spouse, a sister, as ugly as he is, will necessarily love him.
Yeah, yeah.
And again, parallels to Victor and Elizabeth. Mm-hmm. Elizabeth is brought into the Frankenstein family to be a spouse for Victor.
Right.
She is objectified. She never has any choice. And the monster wants Victor to create a woman for him who will have no choice but to love him. The monster doesn't want the female to have the freedom to make a decision to love him or not. He simply assumes
because
that she will. The way that Alphonse and Caroline assume that Elizabeth will be the one for Victor. And this is another case. I mean, you know, as noble and sympathetic as the monster sometimes is, he adopts all of his father's faulty understandings of women. He just objectifies them and reduces them to beings who can't be held responsible for what they do and essentially exist for the pleasure of another person. That's what this female's going to be. It's not a companion the monster will get if one is created that can only serve as a romantic partner and nothing else. That's not a companion. That's a slave. if the female monster is created for one end only, serves only one purpose, she's not being treated like a person. But of course, we're going to find that she's not treated like a person later on when she's aborted halfway through her creation.
That's right. So how does that fit with, Josh, I'm curious your thoughts on this. How does what you're saying fit with one of the types he has, which is the Paradise Lost narrative? Is that what he's attaching the romantic desire to, or is it the De Lacy family, in your opinion?
Well, ask the question one more time.
Where is he getting his desire for a female counterpart? Is it from his observations of the De Lacy family, or is it from the reading of Paradise Lost and Goethe?
It seems as though this is a union of these two things, because he needs the literature to present it as agreeable, and he needs the De Lacy family to present it as possible. So it has to be both desirable and possible in order for him to desire it. Or it has to be good and achievable, in other words. And I think that Paradise Lost suggests that it's achievable, or that Paradise Lost suggests that it's good. And the De Lacy family suggests that it's possible. And so, you know, as with any education, you need both of these things, which is why you've got to do a lot of living in order to make sense of Paradise Lost.
I'm looking over these pages where he describes what he was learning from the different books and even from the story. Because he says, at the beginning of chapter 8, such was the history of my beloved cottagers, which is an interesting word, beloved. It impressed me deeply. I learned from the views of social life which it developed to admire their virtues and to deprecate the vices of mankind. So it does seem that in them he sort of, well, he gets a sense for the notions of right and wrong. He gets a sense that there are such things as virtues and that there are right ways of living and wrong ways of living, that you can make right decisions and wrong decisions. And he says, and yet I looked upon crime as a distant evil. So, and then he goes into this telling of the book, of finding the books. So is it the books that reveal to him that crime is not so distant and evil? Is that what he's saying there?
Read the second half of that sentence.
Looked upon crime as a distant evil. Benevolence and generosity were ever present before me, inciting within me a desire to become an actor in the busy scene where so many admirable qualities were called forth and displayed. But in giving an account of the progress of my intellect, I must not omit a circumstance which occurred in the beginning of the August of the same year. And then one night during my accustomed visit to the neighboring wood, he finds the books.
So what I like that sentence, that sentence stood out to me in my reading, that crime was not yet imagined by him, but benevolence, goodness, and those other adjectives he uses, I still can't remember.
Benevolence and generosity.
Thank you. Are still so compelling. That's what he's drawn to. And so I'm curious, and I want to hear y'all's answer to this, because what you just said about the monster lady being like a slave is curious to me. And I want to hear y'all's thoughts on this, because I have always read his desire for a female monster as natural, as his attempt to imitate Eden. This is his attempt to become, to immerse himself in the story of the world, to have a light-like companion to him. You said earlier, if the female monster is born out of impiety, then it's just another gross distortion of the natural order. And or you proposed that. And so I'm curious, but I've always thought of it as like natural, like the truly in the true sense of the word, he wants an Eve. If he is an Adam, he wants an Eve. And that's the first step towards a redemptive story. But I'm perfect. So do you all see this as a distorted desire on the monster's part?
I see it as a natural desire on his part, but it again goes back to the picture of creation that we're getting, that we didn't ask to be created or born, so we are slaves to our God. You know, I think that's in some ways the essence of the romantic and the current worldview about God, that God was evil to create human beings who suffer and fall.
I think Heidi, you ask a fair question. I want to explain why I think the monster's request is different than Adam's request. Again, this strikes me as a case where the monster has misread or only given a very shallow reading of Paradise Lost. Because while Adam does ask for a companion, it is implied that Adam's companion, the highest point of appeal for Adam's companion will not be Adam, but God. And Eve is free because her highest obligation is to God, not to Adam. Whereas the monster is asking for a creature to be made whose highest obligation is to himself. And the reason why husbands and wives are free as opposed to being in bondage is because their highest obligation is to God, not to one another. But when one's highest obligation is to God, there is freedom. And following the dictates of God over the dictates of man is what makes one free. The monster doesn't get this, though, because in the monster's view of romance, the creator is entirely cut out of the situation. So God creates Adam to be his companion. Eve is Adam's companion, but they're both God's companions. God walked with both of them in the cool of the evening. Whereas the monster says, give me what I want and I'm gonna leave. You will have no say over this. And this woman's highest obligation will be to me. So there's a sense in which Eve is created for Adam, but there's also a sense in which Eve is created for God. God wants Eve, and so does Adam. And thus Eve is capable of satisfying both human and divine desires. But this new monster is not going to satisfy any divine desire. It exists purely for the monster. But it strikes me that a lot of... as we pointed out before, that this is just an adolescent conception of romance.
Right.
That girlfriends and boyfriends exist for the sake of one another, and that both, you know, parents, society, God, the Montagues and the Capulets have nothing to do with, you know, this self-contained, discreet, hermetically sealed-off relationship between lovers.
Karen, you have been... It looks like you're you know, reading passages or busily flipping through the book or something. So I would love to know what you're. you've been a little quiet for the last little while. So we got to turn the floor over to you for a minute here, at least.
No, I don't think I've been quiet at all. I've been taking notes and thinking. I still have to look back at Paradise Lost before I.
Don't we all
write what I'm going to write about this? I still think that the overarching understanding of the monster and his desire for a companion and his relationship with his creator is one in which it reflects a worldview in which we are kind of angry at God for creating us, I guess.
Right.
And, you know, feel like we are slaves because we didn't ask to be born. So.
Yeah, he says, when he's reading Paradise Lost, the monster says it moved every feeling of wonder and awe that the picture of an omnipotent God warring with his creatures was capable of exciting. Mm-hmm. And that's, when I first read that, I kind of glossed over it. And then when you think about it, you think about like, what are, when you, that particular concept of God, as you're saying, of an omnipotent God warring with his creatures, the feelings of wonder and awe that would create are sort of the feelings of wonder and awe that our age is grappling with. Maybe our age needs to read Plutarch.
And that is not the Christian conception of God's relationship with his creation, right? That he's
nor is it Milton's.
That's
to your point. We've all made the point he's reading the book wrong, right? Mm-hmm. And that it's very clear in Milton's Paradise Lost. He is justifying the ways of God to men. He just says it in but to your point, David, and to what you said earlier, Karen, that there is an implied posture within the novel that God is warring with his creatures, mm-hmm. and that the creatures are then in this impossible situation. They find themselves in the position of the monster.
Right, right. Like,
and that's not their fault. Which I was so intrigued by what you said about the normative, that the lack of a normative, nobody telling us mm-hmm. what we're supposed to think about the monster, what we're supposed to think about Victor. And I think that that's true. And this has often been called the first modern novel because of that. Mm-hmm. But that's what makes the novel so rich, right? There's just mm-hmm. this primeval kind of mythological muck that you have to roll around in order to grapple with this novel. It feels like mud rustling sometimes. And you kind of walk away like, ugh. Like just covered with it. And I think that that is what makes it great. But there is an implied, there is an assumption within the novel that the creator is fundamentally vindictive and rejecting towards the creation. And to you, what you just said, it's important to know that is not the Christian ethic. That's not right. the story. They're all embracing the wrong story of the world.
Mm. Well, we talk for an hour and a half and it feels like we barely touched the surface. I want to ask you one last question before we go, and you can answer this quickly if you'd like. Through this point in the book, through volume 2, chapter 9, to what degree do you have sympathy for the monster? And to what, I'll just end my question there. How much sympathy do you have for the monster at this point in the story?
Far, far more than I do for Victor. Far more. But so, yeah, I think I would say I'm sympathetic to the monster, but not blind to the hell within him and that he has that he's created within the world. So sympathetic without letting him off the hook.
Okay. Josh?
I like sympathetic without letting him off the hook. I think that's good. I feel some degree of sympathy for almost everyone in this story, albeit not in equal amounts, because some of them wrong others in horrific ways. Victor wrongs his child in the same ways that he was wronged, and it's hard to say how Alphonse was raised. He probably absorbed a good deal of his own parents' sin. So, I suppose they all live these sort of lamentable, terrible lives, and I feel pity for all of them. Hmm.
Karen?
Yeah, I feel quite a bit of sympathy for the monster, and I think we're supposed to, based on this false myth of, you know, a cruel God who creates people that abandons them or monsters. So
I wanna bring back the question I asked you at the beginning, and I'd love to hear you talk a little bit more about why you chose Frankenstein for your series, especially if it perpetuates, maybe the wrong word, although it proposes what you call a false myth that is not consistent with mm-hmm. the Christian ethic.
Yeah, well, I mean, this series is for Christian readers, and I think, anyone can read it, but obviously that's my target audience, mm-hmm. and I think Christians need to understand the world views and the origins of the world views that are prevailing in our culture today. I mean, and there's no better way to understand those and engage with them than to read works like this. So I think this is an important book for Christians to read for that reason alone, aside from its literary qualities.
All right. Last thing before we go, pitch something. Go the other way. Karen, you first.
Oh my goodness. I have nothing to pitch. I will pitch the conference coming up in a couple of weeks, that I'll be part of and presenting on. So yeah, I'll pitch that.
Yeah. Thank you. If anybody wants to learn more about that, you can go to the website and go to CerseiInstitute.com and, get the information on that. It's a free conference that we're doing, and we had to postpone this year's summer conference. We do a conference every year if you're new, and we had to postpone it to next summer, so we're doing a free online version with a lot of speakers. Karen speaking, Heidi speaking, Anthony Esselin speaking, Lots of people. You can check that out. Josh, what do you want to plug? Your story collection?
No, I'm very excited to announce that I'll be teaching online classes next year through a website that I'm launching in the next several weeks. My first class will be Foundations of Modern Politics. It will be open to anyone 15 and up, a great books class that meets Friday afternoon. And either next week or the week after, I'll have a web address for that site.
Oh, nice. That's exciting. Congratulations.
Thanks. Working on it regularly when I'm not when I'm not finishing up this new book too.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, Heidi?
I'm going to plug the Forma Summer Reading Guide, which you can download. There's links on Instagram and on Facebook. You can find that for your summer reading needs. We had a really fun time creating some guidelines for summer reading that are lighthearted, but also we think really...
Some strategies.
Yeah, there's some good stuff on there.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks to all three of you. Thank you for your time and your insight. And as always, it's been really fun. So for Karen Swallow Pryor, for Joshua Gibbs, and for Heidi White, I'm David Kern. Thanks so much for listening. And until next week, happy reading.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.